Okay, we're, the next section of this will really go to what we are currently doing around issues of security and safety. We have Luis Udice with us, who is our coordinator of security, Pam Nash, who is the assistant superintendent for secondary schools, and we have representative principals, Karen Sino from Cherokee, Colleen Ludholz from Senate, and Alan Harris from East. We also have in the audience and will be available to answer questions about specific their specific school. If you have any, our real intent tonight is not to get to specific incidents, but to talk generally overall. But if there are questions, Joe Gothard is here from La Follette, Bruce Dahman from Memorial, and Ed Holmes from West are all here and available for any questions that anybody has. So, who's up?
And I'll do a brief introduction. From our belief statement, every child has the right to be safe and to live free from violence and harassment. Safety and security are certainly key functions at our school district to make sure that that happens. Ensuring safe schools is a very complex task and does require lots of purposeful activities to make sure that happens. And as Luis would say, it has taught us this is not about building castles and moats for schools. It is about building relationships and engagement and learning. That when students are engaged in schools, when there's appropriate relationships, when they're successful in schools, that certainly decreases the level of violence and security that's needed. So it really is about relationships, engagement, and learning, and about that communication and connections. So with that, we'll kind of walk through our long list of items. We'll just talk kind of from them. We'll try to give some specific school examples and talk more broadly and then give some specific school examples. We'll try to keep track of time. I'm aware that it's about 7, so we'll kind of check in with you a little bit on time.
And I think feel free to ask questions as we go through.
Yes.
As opposed to the end.
I think we would look for a give and take.
Let me just set the stage for the principals who are here this evening so they know when to plug in. We invited Alan Harris to give a description of how he has reorganized his administrative team to better respond more consistently and more rapidly around issues of safety and security. Colleen Ludholz is here this evening to talk about Senate's involvement with not only the Dane County Gang Prevention Task Force, but also the gang prevention curriculum that task force found to be an exemplary program, that one in which their report believes the Senate program should be replicated in a number of places. And then Karen's here this evening from Cherokee to talk about her first year, her experience with a positive behavior support program that's new at Cherokee and what a rather dramatic change it has made in terms of safety and security in her building. So I just wanted to let you guys know where you could plug in.
Okay, I guess I'm on. I'd like to start out by just making reference to Dan's talk about the issue of jurisdiction, and also to point out that schools nowadays are being challenged by incidents that occur outside of school and that often have the potential to come in into the school. An example of that is our incidents, for example, with the use of the Internet or MySpace, where a student may be victimized through the use of the Internet. To the point that it could have repercussions in the school unless that issue is addressed. The schools have been very creative. I've been extremely impressed with the principals in terms of their ability to be able to work with these issues and with these incidents, because they do lots of things that don't necessarily have to fall back upon the student code of conduct and simply can't because we don't have jurisdiction. But they conduct mediation, meetings, they work with families, they work with students, and basically they do everything that they need to do in order to ensure that the schools are safe. But more and more the message is that we cannot ignore incidents that occur outside of our school building, because more and more we are seeing that those incidents are going to follow up into the schools, whether it's a fight that occurs at the transfer point or down the block or through the use of the Internet. Whenever a child is being victimized, we need to pay attention. we simply cannot afford to turn our back on them and say, we can't help you, because many times we can, and our schools do an extremely good job of responding to those issues. So saying that, using that as a reference point, let me just say that the approach to safety in our school district really it consists of a layered approach. It's a multi-layered approach that consists of a building security, for example. And if you look under building security, you could envision layer upon layer of measures within that whole category that would ensure that our school buildings are safe, and that is from installing new locks, installing security cameras, mirrors to areas that maybe are out of the way places within the school building, to having AEDs in the schools so that we're able to respond to medical emergencies. So lots of things under building security. The other one, the other layer would be emergency procedures and responses. We need to have those things in place, and I won't spend a lot of time on that other than to say that we have procedures in place and protocols to be able to respond to just about any emergency that you can imagine that would occur in our school. Training of staff, of course, is critical, not only training of staff, but of students as well, because ultimately we know that in an emergency situation, you cannot depend on a small team of administrators within the school building to be able to take care of all the needs of the entire school. So we need to train staff and students as well. So for that reason, we have drills. We have fire drills, which are mandated by law, but we also have code red drills in case we have an intruder. We need to have teachers step up and assume a leadership role in those situations. We need them to be able to be well prepared to respond to those emergency situations. Tornado drills are another example. We saw what happened last year in Alabama where a tornado struck a school building. So it's those types of things that many times people don't think about, but they're critical to ensuring that schools are safe. The other layer, again, visualizing layers of safety, would be relationships. And relationships is perhaps one of the biggest categories and one of the most critical. And that is engagements between our teachers and the students. Team building within the schools, we've been emphasizing more the aspect of team building and also of developing a sense of community within schools. The analogy that I paint is that when the mayor and the chief of police went out to that huge neighborhood meeting not too long ago where they had 700 people that came out, they did not say the administration or we the police department are going to take care of all your needs. Because they know that they can't. They said, we are going to create partnerships with you, and we are going to work with you as partners to address these issues. And likewise in the schools, we need to get that sense, make sure that everyone understands that. Then we need to create a sense of community within our schools. Our schools are small communities within the larger community, and that's critical. The other aspect of relationships are the relationships that exist with the Madison Police Department and other agencies. Of course, the courts that provide us with information, agencies such as the Neighborhood Intervention Program, Sentry Spano, and then County Social Services. But all these really depend on one aspect that's critical in our schools, and that's leadership, and that's the leadership of our school principals, and they. Because without it, it simply does not happen. But in terms of the nitty-gritty of security, just give you a quick rundown of what we have. All our high schools, as you know, have security cameras. We have between 25 to 30 security cameras in our buildings. They are placed in the common areas of the building. People know where they are. It's no secret. We have policies that address the use of security cameras in our buildings. They serve a small deterrent purpose. They do serve as a deterrent, but more than that, they are instrumental in helping us to determine who was involved in any activities that create an unsafe situation in the school. They have been extremely critical in helping us identify who was involved in fights. People that make bomb threats in schools that have helped us to identify those that are involved. At the same time, it has helped us to eliminate students that are not involved and they are totally innocent. So the cameras are critical to the safety of our schools. We also have security assistants. We have 14 security assistants that are hired and trained by the Madison School District. They train at the beginning of the school year, and they also so attend 2 days of in-service training during the WEAC convention. We have security assistants in each of the high schools. They each have two security assistants, and those that have night school have an additional assistant. So as an example, West and East have three security assistants. Some of our middle schools also have security assistants. They have one apiece. Those are Senate, Sherman, Tokyo, and Cherokee. But they are extremely valuable, and I believe that we get an awful lot for our dollar in return. And what they do, why they're so effective, is that they create those relationships with the students, and that's really the first line of defense, because many times students approach them with information about a kid that may be carrying a weapon or is talking about carrying out some sort of threat in the building.
I have a question on the security assistants. It doesn't appear to be just the size of the middle school, because Hamilton doesn't have one, correct? So is it, how do you select just more?
I believe historically, because that determination was made before I got on board, but I think it had to do with number of incidents. And Hamilton does not have a large number. Sherman, while being smaller at the time that determination was made, had a large number of incidents. And that guard remains.
So then I have a question for one of the middle school principals. What does your security assistant, what would be a typical day for what this person does?
I'll go. Sure. Greet the buses in the morning, supervise breakfast, encourage students to move along to get to their first class on time, logs miles and miles and miles, walking halls every day, looking in classrooms, supervising lunch and recess, dealing with bus issues, our eyes and ears, on the move all the time.
I would have to say the same things. Starting out right away, putting the cones in the parking lot to direct our traffic, being visible in the building and helping supervise and just being out and about.
Thanks. Mr. Winston.
Yeah, is that coupled with also having hall supervision by teachers or staff people? Yeah, when I go to schools, I see a lot of people with walkie-talkies, things like that.
Absolutely. Yeah. In my building, we have 13 people with walkie-talkies, and that is so that if there is a problem, you can walkie-talkie, and immediately there is a number of people who are appearing for support. So the security guard is not the only person doing supervision. We have supervision plans for before school, for during lunch, for when there are changing or passing times, and then after school as well.
Ms. Moss?
Are the EAs and, not EAs, yeah EAs, sorry. Are they determined year by year, or are they a permanent part of your staff that continues each year? Is the school that they go into determined each year, or do you know that
they're... When you say EA, or are you referring to security guard?
Or the ERO?
EROs. I knew I said the wrong thing. Sorry.
The EROs are assigned to our school. We work with the police department. We've been very fortunate the last 2 years. We've hired a new ERO because our ERO got a promotion. So, I mean, it's a good and bad. We bring in a new ERO, but it looks like a good position because they're getting a promotion. So, but we work with the police department and do that interview together. So we interviewed with the police captain and myself and the assistant principal, interview the candidates, do the assignment, and then that ERO is assigned to East unless they apply for a different position within the force, and that's granted.
To be sure everybody's clear, there's two different things. There are education resource officers who are police officers, one in each high school, and they belong to the Madison Police Department. Then there are security assistants, 14, that belong to us and are trained by us and are employees of the school district who are not sworn police officers.
Can I pose an informational question? The security assistants do not have jurisdiction off of school property, right?
That would be correct.
But the EROs would have jurisdiction both on and off?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Correct.
I'd also like to expand on the supervision question. At the high schools, contractually, under the CBA, there are hours available for specifically for hall supervision. And most of our high schools run two individuals in the halls with walkie-talkies every hour. So that's in addition to what you described as teachers out in the halls. That's something that principals always encourage, that adult presence, that extra set of eyes, or just that hopefully friendly presence and voice, shooing kids along to class is another very, very important piece of security.
Dr. Nash, just wondering, has there been any, and also, I guess,
anybody.
Has there been any talk about increasing those numbers depending on a school or an incident or, you know, just something, you know, we know something's coming down the line, let's get some more people there at that school or at, you know.
Yeah, and that's a good question. Actually, when we do have, if we ever have information regarding a threat, a significant threat to a school, we do have the ability to simply, because there are employees, to simply take them from another school and flood that school with additional presence. And we have done that. That works extremely well. The only downside, of course, is that when we do that, then we leave that particular school without their security. But what works so well is that they have been trained by us, so there's that consistency. They know, even though it's a different school, they know how to relate to students, how to work with the administration, and it has worked extremely well.
Do we have any substitutes at all for these positions?
We don't, and we only have them, those that are assigned to the school. We don't have a pool that we can borrow from.
Superintendent, just wondering, had there been any talk in terms of staff about increasing those numbers or having, you know, surplus people, part-time people, you know, that you could move around more?
Well, sir, I mean, certainly I think we all would love to increase the number of our security assistants, particularly. Having someone who is part-time who just comes in for that isn't near as effective, because one of the things that the security assistants do is they learn the children in the school, and even if they have to go into another school, they're accustomed day in and day out to working with principals, to working with teachers, and working with students. So we haven't considered like having a pool of people who just come in part-time, but we certainly have talked about trying to find some way to increase the number of actual security assistants in the schools. I mean, the bottom line is the more eyes you have out there and the more people that can interact with kids during those passing times and those kind of things, the better.
Is our contracts with, in terms of the City of Madison, in terms of the EROs, obviously that's City of Madison, is there anything contractually that would prevent our school district from contracting with the county for sheriff's deputies or anything like that in for a particular, not necessarily incidents, but let's say there's a, something happens or, you know, and we want to have more hands on deck. Is that any type of possibility?
Madison police are very good, in my sense, are very, very good about when we have instances that would require a large presence of police officers coming, and they're used to working with us. So we haven't at this point in time, unless Louis can think, had a need to bring the county or anyone else in. Madison police are very good partners, and they are very willing to, at this matter, at the start of this year, they had groups of officers who just came in and were a presence in the school meeting people earlier in the year. So we really haven't lacked in that area.
But when we pay people, do we, like let's say we were to bring in some other, I'll say EROs, some other people, would we pay them, would we compensate them at the special duty pay, or do we compensate them at, with their regular salary? Obviously the ones that we have, the four, right. I know we can compensate at that level, but again, if there's situations that happen and you want to, you know, again, more presence at a school for a certain period of time? Would we compensate people at a different level?
Actually, no, and we get quite a deal because they're free. In emergency situations where if the police, and this is where the relationship issue is critical, the relationships that the principals have been able to build with the district captains, is that if they agree that there's an emerging situation that may threaten the safety of the school, they will simply add whatever necessary additional officers are needed, and that's at no cost to the school district.
To clarify, though, we may use off-duty policemen at a dance or at a football game or something like that, pulling security. Not as a policeman, but as an off-duty policeman, and there is a rate for them, I'm sure, that they charge.
Yes, but there's a union rate for off-duty, but
Sure. But has that, again, been floated around as an option? Say you do want to have, again, more hands on deck for a certain period of time, maybe a couple weeks or you know, really kind of what we would call in the fire service and probably more in the police department is a show of force. You know, you've got a problem, there was an incident, we're going to say, look, we're not tolerating that, but we got to bring in some more people. And again, just as you said, in terms of the security assistant positions, if you move people around, you leave a hole at the school that, you know, the person is coming from.
Yeah. Please don't let this get out, but actually the city has agreed to use overtime funds to add whatever resources are needed at the school. So that's the importance that the city, from the chief and the mayor, place on the safety of our school. So what you're referring to, Johnny, is actually what the department has been doing, that is paying out of their own pocket to create that presence whenever it's needed in the schools.
Okay, that's good.
It's worked out very well.
Thank you.
So just to wrap up I'm sorry.
Ms. Mathiak has a question.
Could you give me an idea of how many times in the last year we've actually been at that point where we really required additional police services at one of our schools?
Yeah, certainly. At the beginning of the school year, the police department actually had gathered information that there was going to be significant gang activity at a couple of our high schools. Specifically, they had gathered information that Latino gangs were planning some sort of an event to establish their dominance over a certain school or neighborhood. As a result of that, two of our high schools received additional police presence during the first 2 weeks of school, where the police simply came, they mingled with the students, they were in our schools, and it was, once again, at no cost to the school district. But that's perhaps the best example that I can give you. But there have been other incidents where if they have received information of that sort, they have simply, many times the beat officer that's working the neighborhood will simply step in and hang out at the school or work with the ERO just to give the ERO that additional added presence in the school.
So that we're talking primarily preventive, not in response to something that has happened.
Yes.
Because I think it's a really important distinction when dealing with the public. Some schools get typecast as sort of violent, bad places to go, and I would hate for people to think that we've got armed camps, you know, because our schools are so dangerous, we can't possibly exist without tons of cops in the corridors. But maybe Mr. Harris would like to say something.
Well, East is typecast as the state girl swim champion from now on.
So there you have it. I also would like to say that I have been at East High School when something was bubbling up with kids. And we think we're talking in terms of EROs and security assistants, but I have to say that watching the walkie-talkie people at East converge is quite amazing. And I think we forget that we've got in the schools a group of people that function very impressively, in my experience, when there is a crisis.
It's very important to remember that safety and security in schools requires everybody on the staff. It's not, I mean, you know, obviously we have security assistants and they do some things, and we have EROs in our high schools and we have administrators, but ultimately it takes everybody working together, and our staffs do a good job of that. It takes everybody working together to make that happen.
I just want to follow up on that real quickly. My kids are in a middle school without a security assistant, and I've been there when things have started to, you know, get a little heated. And the teachers, it's amazing. In just a matter of a minute, there will be four teachers converging on that spot, and it's pretty much diffused at that point. So I think, like you said, Mr. Raymar, that this, the staff, the teachers are all doing a really good job.
And which leads right into the training aspect, and I was going to say that those types of actions and responses by staff don't happen by accident. Once again, it starts out with the leadership of the school principal, and also falls back on the training that staff received. This year, at the beginning of the school year, everyone in the district received training on the management of conflict that was provided by Dr. Jim Haisley and myself. It was first provided to all our administrators, so our principals, and then it was the videotape was shown to all staff at every school within the district. We have continued to add that to go back to schools and to provide additional training. Basically, what we're teaching them are crisis intervention skills, de-escalation techniques. We discuss board policy, of course. And the goal, the objective, is to teach de-escalation techniques and to manage conflict effectively, but also, of course, to enhance the safety of students and staff. And the cornerstone of this whole effort, this training, is the building of supportive and trusting relationships, because that ultimately that's what's going to determine whether a situation is going to be resolved safely or not.
Could you tell me if that training includes discussion of when it is appropriate to use contact with students to de-escalate a situation?
Yes, absolutely. And actually what we stress is that the use of force, and again we discussed the board policy, that the use of force has to be absolutely the last step, and it should only be resorted when all other options have been utilized and explored.
I'm asking because I remember a couple suspensions that came up in the last year and a half that I've been on the board that involved students who were very angry, and somebody tried to grab them, or did grab them, mm-hmm. around the arms and the waist, and the student struggled and hit the staff member. They ended up being expelled because they struck a staff member. But as a parent who has faced some heated exchanges with teenage males, I also know that the last thing I would probably do is grab them. Mm-hmm. So I really encourage some very wide-based staff trainings on.
We started our school year. Luis came and met with all of us. We did three different sessions where Luis met with staff members and actually walked through the process of, you know, how we want to engage in the conversation with students when they are escalating. And certainly, you know, as Mr. Rainwater talked about, you know, it's really trying to build trust relationships, and teachers have to be able to depend on security. Security has to be able to depend on administration. You know, it's an interweaving loop that happens every day, and being able to, you know, make those snap decisions that are right in front of you all the time. It only happens if we do feel like we're trusting each other. Luis has been great about coming out and working with our staff on specifically that question.
I think the cornerstone of the presentation that was done to all staff was a huge discussion on de-escalating verbally, using words first, and being very, very careful about those words, the choice of words, and being very respectful of the cultural context in which those words were being used, heard, delivered. So I think, and we will continue that work as well, but it was wonderful to know that the entire staff on our full day in service had that information.
Ms. Cole.
I had a question about that training. Does that include the entire MMSD staff? Does it include this may be a silly question, but janitorial staff and coaches yes. and administration?
Yes, everyone received the same information.
Okay. And then the other question is, getting back to this hall supervision, and you said that principals, you know, encourage. What do you do when a staff member chooses not to get involved? I'm sure that must come up at times, and how do we track it as a district, and what can we do as a board to encourage that?
And we'll certainly hear from the principals. There is the art of persuasion that is something that's a very important part of a principal's arsenal. And there also is, I think, as Luis aptly described, the building of community. And within that community, there does at some point become a wonderful shift and peer pressure, teacher on teacher. Let's help each other is a very, very important component as well. But then we also do have an evaluation process, a supervision and evaluation process that we utilize with our teachers. And while we can't necessarily order teachers to be in the hallways, we certainly can talk about the critical nature of building relationships, because from my experience, teachers who don't want to be in the halls also don't build very good relationships with kids in the classrooms. So it's a broader picture than just that supervision piece, but I'm sure that they will want to comment as well.
I just wanted to make a quick comment before that, is that I find it interesting that the teachers union sends me this solidarity newsletter, and in it there's always this encouragement of you don't have to do anything. It kind of defeats this purpose of building relationships, and you know, obviously have some of the best principals that we have up here, I know we have a lot of great principals, and I hope that they can give us some insight on how to go about building relationships.
Well, I think, one, it's important to clarify a couple things. There's the being out in the hallways and being present for students, but then we also have teachers who volunteer to do hall supervision during their prep times. Those are two different things. And again, for us at least at East, and in trying to work on it, first and foremost, we need to work on being very fair, firm, and consistent with students, so that from our security to our teachers to our assistant principals to our kids, there was a sense of knowing what to do when something happened and knowing there was going to be a response. Because I think, you know, in conversations I've had with teachers, oftentimes, 90% of the time, their reluctance is because they had an experience of some kind that has made them uneasy. Whether it was that there was a perception there wasn't follow through, or there was a situation where there was an interaction with a student and they were disrespected and didn't know how to respond. So sometimes it's just literally having that one-to-one conversation to find out at the heart of the reason of what is going on. And as I said, 90 to 95% of the time, there's something there that there needs to be a building of trust and a sense that there is going to be support. Because the last thing you want is any student or any human being is to stand in front of someone and say, will you please stop, and have them completely ignore you and pretend you don't exist, or to turn around and tell you that you don't exist. And both of those have a very internal feeling to them about what do I do with that. And it is really working with our staff about how do we work through that. And every day we have issues where someone asks a question, what happened, what was a follow-through, or this happened. What we try to do is build that sense of support so that if a teacher is frustrated, there's another colleague they can talk to who knows that there's someone that they can talk to, that we have an assistant principal who is making those connections, that our security is out and present. So we do a hall sweep hourly, and that involves teachers and security and assistant principals all working on it. So there's that sense of kind of coming together around it. And I think over time, we've seen a building of teachers being more comfortable than being in the hallway between classes, primarily because they know there's a purpose to it, and hopefully they know that there's going to be support for whatever happens beyond wherever there's an issue. And I just think it takes time and consistency.
And I guess I'm going to add in communication. One of the things I think my staff have seen is that if there is an issue and it's a serious issue, people respond, but they don't have to necessarily be the front person taking the lead. They know that whoever started taking the lead is in the lead unless they give up their lead. And so it's just sometimes to physically be there, just to be there. We also hold voluntary staff meetings if there's a big incident so that we are communicating with the entire staff and we can answer questions about what the situation was about, how it was resolved, what went well, what didn't go well, what should we do better next time, what unique situation came up that we haven't thought about before, and how will we respond to it the next time. And I think processing like that with the staff really pulls the staff together and helps with that sense of community.
A benefit of working in a medium-sized school is that there are no strangers. You simply cannot escape. Every adult has the opportunity to know your name and typically know how you interact. And that is beyond helpful when kids are reluctant to move along or they have a conflict. I need to stress, though, that we're not just talking about teachers. We're talking about our BRS, our EAs, our clerical staff. Every single body in the building has a responsibility to interact with kids, to encourage them, to redirect them, not just teachers, because we absolutely could not do it with just teachers.
Ms. Mathiak.
I know that you probably want to get on, but I want to also talk about the kids in the halls. Last spring, the Partnerships Committee had a very interesting presentation by some of the students who work with Gay Straight Alliance for Safe Schools, and they had done some really cool projects where they had done essentially safety inventories to talk with kids about where they felt safe, where they had seen unsafe things happen or seen things happen that made them feel unsafe, and had then mapped it out in the on a diagram of the school layout. And I'm wondering if any of you have done anything like that in your schools, you know, if there's any thought about doing that in our schools, because I looked at it and I thought, boy, there's some real information here, because as an adult, you know, I don't have a whole lot of places I feel unsafe. I've discovered that some very thuggish kids will snap too if you command their respect. But a high school kid in a large place or a middle school kid in an unfamiliar place can be a completely different game. So
our GSA for Safe Schools did a survey at East. It was about a two-year project. And, you know, I think one of the things that really jumped out was comments from students who had witnessed harassment or bullying, not knowing what to do and not necessarily knowing who to go to do with that. And it is, I mean, one of those very difficult hearsay situations and those types of things that we've worked on trying to create, you know, as we begin this year, our students, student congresses, message for the year is diversity and pride. We are the East Side, and the sense of trying to bring together and then having those conversations. Hopefully our Congress begins to work on that and those kinds of things. It is an issue that isn't easily resolved, but our students are aware of it, and the next steps are to talk about, you know, what do we do next?
I guess what I was saying is actually physical places. You know, for example, what really jumped out, and I was sitting next to Mr. Amor, I said, boy, you know, that one corridor in that school looks great, but what's going on over there? Because there was this like, blob of little dots where people had bad experience, you know, had felt threatened. And so, you know, for example, you know, the area, just getting to the computer arts room, that one that's way up, and the adults all get lost at back to school night. You know, are there places or the area in the bottom basement where the auto shop and wood shop has been getting, can be maybe or maybe not. Have you done any of that with East?
I think that's been a huge asset with our security. They do a terrific job of managing the cameras and then looking at those areas. We are aware of, you know, many of those kind of hotspot areas and those things, and it changes. You know, it evolves throughout the school year. Students are really intelligent. And so I think, but our security is a huge asset there, and our hall monitors, in terms of they do a great job of being able to talk with students about where things are, and certainly it's not perfect, but we kind of do kind of a regular idea of where that is.
At Senate, we used our student council to provide some of that same information, and we had some surprises by some of the information that they provided, so it was worthwhile, and we were able to implement some changes that I think really reinforce for students how important it is that they continue to be having those conversations and letting the adults know and not assuming we know everything.
We surveyed our students a few years ago and identified a place we knew as kind of a hot spot, but once we had some considerable facilities work done, new lights, new ceilings, new floors, we could actually see all the way to the end of the hall, and magically the nonsense disappeared.
Maybe we'll have principals talk about their. I don't want to make sure we end without having you talk about your areas. So, however order you want to do that.
Every middle school this summer sent a training team to learn about an approach to behavior management called Positive Behavior Interventions and Supports. At Cherokee, we shortened the acronym to PBS because we didn't want middle schoolers saying PBUS, PUBUS, that sort of thing. So I'm going to call it PBS. Get out in front of it. I was a fan even before we implemented it because the focus is on explicitly teaching positive behaviors. We have taken it on in a way I don't think we've taken on any other behavioral approach. And before we implemented it, I had smart, caring people implementing humane, flexible practices and policies, and we thought we were getting some pretty decent results. But once we started actually teaching children explicitly what we were looking for, walk on the right side of the hall. You'd be amazed how many 13-year-olds don't know that that's an expectation until it's taught. Actually modeling those behaviors for them, taking the whole class in the hall and actually marching them down the right side. And then acknowledging those students when they actually give you the desired behaviors and celebrating those behaviors and giving every adult in the building a role in teaching, redirecting, and celebrating. It has made such a difference that since we started school, we have cut our referrals to our timeout room, we call it our above-the-line room now, in half. So that's that much more time on task, time in the classroom. And for the most part, I'm talking about the kids who just need a 10-minute timeout, who just need to stop giggling, stop snorting, stop doing whatever middle school kids are doing. But 10 minutes a day, once a day, three times a day, is a lot of learning time. We have a very powerful PBS team. I'm a member of it, but I'm not the leader of it. We have a captain who is a sixth grade academic teacher, and it has perhaps the most diverse membership of any committee we've ever put together in school, because I think for the first time, every person feels as though there's a place for me, no matter what my role. It's going so well that this group meets probably every other week, taking a look at referral data, talking about ways to intervene for students who are showing up too much in our ATL room, soliciting mentors to provide some additional support for those kids, and doing a lot of follow-up. It's become quite a production in our school, probably because there are 700 people focused on it. We teach probably two behaviors a month. We identified those behaviors we needed to improve on this summer, and so they're specific to every school. So the things we're teaching are probably the same things that Colleen is teaching at her school. So we've spent a lot of time talking about classroom behavior and hall behavior in little bits, and then we will recycle through those lessons throughout the year. And students know, again, concretely what we expect. So it's almost like giving them a signal, just a word in the hall, and they get it. We hold a drawing after every lesson, and it's a big deal on the PA, and we publish their photos on our website, and we allow kids to choose some cool things. This morning we had a drawing, and the prize of choice was a monkey that wouldn't stop chattering, that the teachers just despise but the kids love. It's a token economy, that's for sure. It's not the goods, though, that seems to have the kids' attention. It's the focus of every single adult in the building. After the lessons are finished in the classroom, every adult receives a couple of cool little tickets that are called gotchas, one in English and one in Spanish, and they actually troll the building during the week of instruction looking for kids who are doing the right thing and lay it on them. And we have kids who covet these little things so much they won't turn them in to have a chance to be chosen, just because the acknowledgement is sufficient for them. We had no idea that our numbers were going to be cut in half. And we're pretty confidently making a positive correlation between the full implementation of PBS as well as the above-the-line approach. And we'll take a look in 3 months, but we really think we're on to something. I'm a fan.
Likewise, at Senate, we have also been implementing the PBIS, we still call it PBIS, approach. And nobody's called it anything inappropriate. But now it probably will happen. I think that Pam really wanted me to speak a little bit to some of the prevention activities that we have been implementing over the last few years to really address gang kinds of activity. Being right next door to a high school lends particular challenges at times, also particular advantages that other schools don't have. When I first started at Senate Middle School 5 years ago, we had significant gang issues going on. And 2 years ago, when I peaked in my suspensions, a lot of that was related to gang behavior and students that were heavily recruited and recruiting other students. So we had to take a pretty quick and pretty heavy approach to how we handled things, because it was very clear that there was a lot going on that was not safe and was preventing students from being successful. We started with staff training, because one thing I found immediately was the staff wasn't really well informed about what to watch for. And so we had gang knowledgeable people come in and talk about what was happening in our community and what was happening in our neighborhoods with gangs, what kinds of gangs were out there, what kinds of symbols and graffiti they were using and what it meant. And then we talked about, as a staff, in addition to building strong relationships, in addition to all the educational pieces, what else do you need to be alert for and aware of, and then how do you handle that? So if students are doodling and writing graffiti on their assignments, the teachers are not accepting those assignments and the students are required to rewrite them and then turn them in. So students in our school know now that they cannot be using graffiti, that they can't wear gang colors, that Senate is a no-gang zone, and that we have students at our school who have family members who are gang members, who may themselves be gang members, and that's their personal choice. But as long as it stays off school grounds, what we're about is learning, and everyone is welcome at our school, and everyone belongs in our school. And so we try to approach things on a very dignified manner. We talk to students individually if we have concerns. We have their parents come in. We've done all kinds of things in terms of trying to build really our student capacity for responding to recruitment, and also our staff capacity for how to support our students that are contemplating those very heavy decisions. We had to really up our supervision outside of the school, and so things like having playground locks put on the building so that the only entrance to our building is the front door was really helpful. We had to train our lunch supervisors what to watch for if cars were driving in our parking lot and, you know, kind of circling around and didn't look like they were there for school business. We needed to radio in those license plates and communicate with the ERO at La Follette. That's one of the advantages of being next door. We can communicate with them as well. We also asked at times for La Follette staff to join us when it was dismissal time, or we joined them just for extra presence in cases where cars were driving by and trying to stop and talk with our students or send messages through other students. So as a result, I can very honestly say that right now, do we have members at our school that are in gangs? Yes. Do they come to school every day for learning? Yes. And do we have a very safe campus? Yes. They know where to go for support. They know that if they come to us and say, I made a bad choice and I need help figuring out how to get out of this decision that I made, that we will provide the support and we will use our community connections to help them and support them. So I don't think that Senate is doing anything much more unique than any of the other schools. It was just that we had a pretty heavy-duty problem initially, and now I feel like we're on top of it. We're working well with our community agencies and our high school right next door, so we're all working on it together.
We, in 05-06, as an administrative team with the assistant principals and our dean of students, tried to look at what actions were we taking that were moving us forward and where were there things that, that in our structure and organization made us less effective at our work. And certainly, you know, as we heard the hearing officers talk a little about tonight, you know, every day we have parents who very much want to make sure that if something happens, it's going to be dealt with fairly and appropriately, and appropriate consequences are going to be given. They also want to know that the student is going to be dealt with fairly and appropriately, and it's going to be very consistent. And as we work through that process, one of the challenges we realized we faced structurally was we had four assistant principals who all had responsibilities such as supervising teachers or working on a master schedule or putting together a graduation. And simultaneously, we're also responsible for the overall discipline of a grade level, and felt like in that structure, we weren't as consistent and as effective as we could be in how we followed through, but more importantly, trying to get into a more proactive mode. Working with the assistant principals and a lot of input from our ERO, from our security, we sat down and discussed with our department chairs many things and redesigned our structure to where we have an assistant principal whose focus and responsibility is really building safety, security, and support. So he oversees, he works with the dean of students, the resource officer reports directly to him, he works with all the security officers, he coordinates all of the supervision and discipline that happens in the school. Doesn't mean he does every single piece of it, but if another assistant principal is called in to work on it, they're working with that assistant principal so that we know we are consistent. For the first time as we came into this year, last year, 06-07 was our first year in that structure, and we came in, you know, that assistant principal was able to come in at the beginning of the year and have very clear data about what had happened and very clear goals about what his next steps were, specifically around how we engage students and how we support students and certainly that student discipline piece. At the same time, another assistant principal is focusing on the classroom, has the core academic areas. Another assistant principal works on transitions and supports and the guidance and support piece and focusing on the freshman areas. Another assistant principal is working on our electives and our extendeds and our FIED and working with activities and athletics and has that focus. And then, of course, the team has to come together. But we felt like it's a structure that has allowed us as a team to be more effective in the sense that we have somebody whose eye is on that target. Whereas in the past,
person may be working on supervising a teacher or maybe working on a master schedule and get pulled away to a discipline issue that they're not able to be as focused on because they've got some other responsibilities. So by focusing certain efforts, we've been able to feel like we've been more consistent in how we practice day to day.
Thank you. We thought I might wrap up this part by talking a little bit about, just for a couple minutes, about what we do district-wide on some very specific kinds of issues. And then after I do that, which will take just a few minutes, then we might want to check in and see if you want us to stop here, come back with our proposal for next year, or you want us to keep going.
Are you still in part three?
We're on part three, and I'm going to wrap that up.
Okay.
We provided you, we believe very, very strongly, and this goes to everything that we try to do as an administration in the school district, that good things happen because you plan for good things to happen. They don't happen by accident. So we spend a lot of time planning everything. One of the things that we provided you, I think, was copies tonight of various procedures that we have developed over the years. These are reviewed regularly. They're available in all of our schools. This is how we handle some very specific kinds of issues within the school. And what I thought I might do is spend a little bit of time talking about our crisis response checklist, just to give you an idea of how that planning works. The crisis response checklist actually was begun by Mary Gulbranson as chief of staff now many years ago. It's been added to many times since. Every time we have a major kind of incident in a school, whether that would be the death of a student, whether that would be a threat, we have certainly had instances where there were threats of somebody coming in from the outside, or whether that's a bomb threat that requires evacuation. Anything that presents a major crisis that affects the school, our crisis checklist goes into effect. And it really lays out all the various steps that we're going to take, everything from who's going to be involved with handling the crisis, to what kind of communication are we going to do with parents, what kind of communication are we going to do with the press. It lays that out in very clear detail. It's actually managed by Ann Wilson and in my office. And a couple of three fundamental things that we've learned over the years. When we have a major crisis that's going to involve the whole school, we send three people from the central office to manage that crisis. Ken Syker, Joe Quick go from our public information office, and they deal with the press. And they're the only ones who deal with the press on site. Luis deals with the first responders, with the police or fire department, whoever that happens to be, and he is the only one that does that. Pam or Sue go, depending on the level of the school, and they are dealing with overall administration. What that does is that allows the principal at the school to be concerned with their kids and their staff so that they don't have to be concerned with the things going on externally to that. They're concerned with what's going on inside their building with their individual people. We establish a command center down here that's fully manned, and they establish a command center in the school that's fully manned so that we have communication all the time through that. We are making decisions throughout that process about how to notify parents about where we are. One of the things we learned in the last 3 or 4 years is with cell phones and text messaging and everything else, many times parents at home know before we do what's going on at the school. So with Infinite Campus and our ability to broadcast messages, that's made our communication obviously an awful lot better. At the end of each incident, we sit down and debrief that incident fully and say, okay, what did we learn from that incident that we need to do different than we've done in the past? What worked? What didn't work? What do we need to add to the checklist? What do we need to change? So for us, it's an evolving process. It's been highly successful for us, I think, in terms of managing issues. An example was in the really tragic accident that we had at Cherokee this year. One of the things we learned, because it was the very first time that we've ever had an incident in which our own staff were the first responders. We've never had that before. And so one of the things we learned from that was to bring in a counselor who specifically deals with first responder trauma. And that was a major thing that we learned when we have that kind of situation, because that's a completely different kind of situation. Both the command center also has the ability to bring in counseling services that many times are our own or can be counseling services from the county if we need that, and we've certainly had occasions where we did that. We can rally counselors very, very quickly for various kinds of counseling to go on in the school. So from a district level, that's pretty much the way that we look at everything as we deal with the kind of crisis that involves a whole school as opposed to a single incident that's going on in a school. So that wraps up three, and I'll leave it up to y'all. If you want us to continue, we can continue, or we'll be glad to come back
Does anyone have a... In part four is in recommendations of what you're thinking for.
Actually, these
future.
Are the things we're thinking about doing.
Yeah, I think we probably should follow through on that because I think we're waiting breathlessly here. It's just the TV audience.
Yeah, this would probably be, one of the more important parts of the discussion.
With the Hollywood writers on strike, we have a much bigger audience these days.
We're the entertainment, is that right?
Right.
All right. We'll have Pam start with some of the school-wide discussions and follow up and just walk through some of the recommendations.
One of the things that was very clear when we had some incidents at West at the beginning of the year, or sort of into the year, was a strong need for increased communication. And I did want, and West responded very, very well, not only with one neighborhood meeting and a parent meeting, but also with some follow-up activities that went on in the building directly with students, additional information for parents. And I don't know how many copies of this that Ed brought along tonight, but I did want to show you that they put together this very, very well done missive to parents and to kids that not only contains a letter from the principal describing what had been going on and a strong message about the importance of everybody pulling together to keep West a safe place, but also some very excellent tips, personal safety guidelines that came from the Madison Police Department that include safety at home, safety on the street, safety in your car, safety on public transportation, and safety in public places. All of those areas had been very important because some of the West incidents had happened off of campus. And I think this level of detail, and we certainly will get a copy to you, was well received by parents and students alike. And also a very clear outline to this particularly of interest to parents of how is West supervised, who's assigned where, and how might those people be found if needed, that kind of thing. And a great page that started, the title is Everyone Has the Right to Feel Safe. And I think that speaks to what West is doing. The other schools certainly have plans in the works for a similar kind of outreach. Particularly, I think that outreach to students is very, very critical. So that has gone on and will continue to go on as well.
Want me to keep going? For a couple of times this fall, we brought in the high school principals and brought in the middle school principals to have a discussion about safety and security, kind of a major debrief about what do we need to do and what are we doing already that is meeting our needs. And out of that came some of the items that we'll talk a little bit about. One of them was the school-wide discussion and follow-up, that at all school sites there would be a purposeful discussion about safety and security, about how students are feeling safe, about what they can do, about what staff can do, and that across the board in all of the schools we do have that, whether it comes in per Golder time or whether how it comes, how we set that format in the smaller learning communities, but that we would have formal discussions in all of the high schools and schools about it. Second, we talked about individual interventions for identified students and case managers. The idea that all of the schools could identify certain groups of students or individual students who they felt like had an influence in a negative way on their school or, in fact, had been involved in incidents. And the idea is that how do we better create a relationship with those kinds of students, that a case manager kind of person who checks in with them, who monitors them, who works with them, who has the knowledge about this student and their family and their situation. And so all of us talked about this notion of being able to work with some identified students who we already knew, but who we could develop a relationship with so that we could get them in classes, we could get them to what they need to do. But the key piece we heard across the board was that relationship and a case manager kind of person.
Yeah, I wanted to emphasize the idea of a very small group of identified students who are most at risk of creating violence in the school and dealing with them individually. One of the things that we may want to do is to talk to them as a group and find out what kinds of things lead to this, how do we help you, but ultimately managing each of them individually with a case manager so that there is somebody who's following up, there is somebody for them to check in with, so that we are, in fact, trying to alter their behavior through that very strong kind of relationship so that we're actually changing them, if you will, in place. So that serves as a model for the other kids also as we begin to work with them. So that was, we think that's really a key piece, is to concentrate on that very small group of kids who are most prone to this kind of issue and try to change their behavior.
And one thing that we talked about as we were talking about that sort of case manager piece was we have in place a good model, and that's the habitual truancy interview protocol, which is a very extensive interview to kind of get at the root cause of why a student gets into that kind of behavior. And so we're going to be examining that specific interview. I certainly have talked to a number of counselors, psychologists, social workers, assistant principals, who have used that protocol and found truly ways that they could assist a student, got information that they would not have gotten in any other way, shape, or form, and then could design an intervention for that student that really met that student's very, very personal needs at that point.
Yeah, I think it's important to remember that these are very individual instances. They're not... This isn't 25 kids who are all the same. These are 25 very, very individual kids. And so by establishing a protocol kind of interview that goes through some very, very specific steps that our psychologists and social workers can help us design, we can get to some of those individual things that then lead to how you work with that individual child.
I have a question partly for Dr. Nash. Thinking along those lines, last spring when we were talking about school consolidation and we were talking about the middle schools, Blackhawk, Sherman, and O'Keefe, one of the discussions that we had at some point in time was resources in the fact that these schools at a certain size don't have full-time guidance counselors, may not have full-time psychologists, and that we were talking about the advantages of potentially consolidating them. What everyone has said today focuses on, you know, having those people in the schools develop relationships with the students, which right. Certainly makes sense. So what is, in these types of schools, is it of this size, now that we have part-time resources, is it more of a challenge? Is there something that you're going to have to do differently? Is it an issue?
Well, certainly it's an issue, and certainly it's much more of a challenge. It causes you to have to rethink some things. What the superintendent said is very true about this being what we're talking about being a very individualistic kind of thing for a kid. But sometimes we have to utilize our resources in clusters. We have to bring kids together when we do not have those full-time people. And it also, I think, makes us look at the classroom as a resource in a little bit broader way than perhaps we have. Developmental guidance is something that is not implemented in our schools that have part-time counselors, and that's a good avenue and a good way to sort of get that information out about what you're thinking and feeling right now because of your age is exactly what you should be or isn't even vaguely what you should be. So sometimes group work is an answer to that as well. But would a full complement of support people be great for every school? Yes, it would.
Ms. Mathiak, followed by Ms. Cubs, followed by Ms. Moss.
Yeah, I'm sitting here and thinking about that's such a good question, you know, in terms of what resources are there to provide that one-on-one.
You've been an advocate for the
support services. I have
for a long
to say
time.
It's yeah. This has sort of taken me to consideration of what we're going to be talking about in a few weeks when we think about equity and we think about the budget for the coming year and what types of factors we take into account. And I'm wondering if we have students that not students per se, but students in combinations in some schools that would really present an argument for allocating resources that we normally wouldn't allocate. Do we have schools that need that type of resource because that would provide the critical difference between a good and safe learning environment and a very fragile set of circumstances?
Can I comment?
Please, sure.
I have two social workers and one school psychologist, and they are key to the prevention activities that we do at Senate. We have divided our school into three, and so each of them is a primary person for two houses at Senate. They work with the students in those houses. They set up and work with neighborhood partners or community partners in providing a whole range of prevention groups. So it can be anything from dealing with grief and loss all the way through how do you make friends in middle school through making good choices or dealing with families that have alcohol or drug issues and how do you survive in that situation. So we have totally shifted from being kind of crisis and reactive to being preventative. And it is because we have built the capacity of those support staff to be able to recognize the problems, to work with the students and build those relationships in groups, and to develop curriculum for doing that. It's been highly successful.
I think the places where we have the most problems in terms of staffing are those where the school is below 500. They don't have an assistant principal, so they only have one administrator in the building. And when they get down small enough that they begin to have part-time social workers and psychologists, but yet there's still 350, 400 kids. Those are where we suffer the most from lack of resources.
And are any of the schools in that strait, would they fall in a category if we were saying, you know, we need to be aware that we need to make resources a priority? Do we have schools that are fragile, that are in that size?
My sense from our meetings with the middle, I mean, the high schools are all big, but my sense from the meetings with the middle school principals was that their problems, their number of problem kids sounded very similar across all the two smaller ones with less, but with one exception that I can think of as principals talked around the table, the number of students that we're talking about that were issues were very, very similar regardless of the size of the school. Not sure what that says, but they were very, very similar regardless of the size of the school. So if I'm in a school of 300, listening to the principals describe the number of children that we would identify, that number would be very similar to what Karen would have at Cherokee, even though they have only 300 kids. Now, I don't know if that means there's 10 kids that rise to that level. Once you use 11 kids, I don't know. But that was the sense that we got that day.
Ms. Cubza, followed by Ms. Moss.
Yeah, my question was very similar to Lucy's, that I think that this is an issue that we'll need to look at when we get to the equity discussion and density of, if you talked about 25 kids that are causing an issue, is that the same at every school or not? And how do we evaluate it? And then do we allocate resources based on that? So I think that will be a really interesting discussion to have in December.
Ms. Moss?
I think the idea of the case manager is a wonderful idea. I was wondering if, maybe I missed this, but will the case managers be staff? Would they be teachers, or would they all be psychologists? And how would they be trained? Do you have
We're still in the development stage of all this. We will be returning to the board to request some allocation of the additional reimbursement from special ed that we receive. And our request will involve how to staff the kinds of things that we're going to finally come up with here, with those case managers being one of those things that we're talking about, which would be someone. I think it's more the person than it is the job than their certification. I think it's much more the person that you really have to want to do this, and you really have to be a skilled person at interacting with students who are troubled at best. So, but we will we do plan to return to the board to ask to invest the additional reimbursement we got in special ed into the safety and security of our secondary schools. And exactly what that's going to look like, we're not sure. What we're telling you is the ideas that we have right now.
Ms. Carstensen.
Along that line, one of the things that I've often felt we need is the flexibility to provide a shot of resources for a limited period of time just to get things under control. It has seemed to me that that sometimes a school has a mix of kids that present a particular problem that needs to be dealt with right away, and once you've established some acceptable responses, you can pull people out. And so as you look at things, I would really hope that we talk about whether that's a feasible kind of thing and whether it would have, you know, whether it would in fact work. I know this is theoretical on my part.
Okay.
Great.
Ms. Mathiak?
Sorry, and this is actually a question for Mr. Hartley. I know that you've been engaged with the disconnected youth initiatives that are going on in our community. Are there opportunities to connect some of the types of initiatives we're talking about here, especially things that really focus on kids who are at risk, with the disconnected youth initiatives? Are there some opportunities to pool resources?
I mean, yes, I would say the same thing about the Dane County Task Force, Gang Task Force, and the initiative with disconnected youth. They're about partnerships with community agencies and groups to work together. And so how do you coordinate all of those resources? And I think we're beginning to do that as recommendations come out of both those task force. Let me walk through a couple of other the items that we've got that we're talking about. When we sat with the high school principals, we heard a lot about group interventions. It isn't just about an individual student. They often, as appropriate, will pull in families and groups of kids, do mediation, do talking, do understanding, but all four of the high school principals could clearly identify times they pulled people in as groups and times that's very appropriate. We are going to review the administrative team structure of all of the four high schools east. We're going to kind of set the model as best practice, and the other three high schools are going to follow suit. So we are going to make that move in terms of doing the restructuring following the east model. We heard a lot about better communication to parents and the community about incidents and events. Some of the things that came up from the West Talking Session were, can you use the websites of the PTSO presidents? How do we better communicate those events other than just a letter? Are there other avenues of communication? So we're talking with the principals about we need to communicate with the community more about things that are happening. And so that was one of the key things we heard loud and clear from some of the community sessions.
Yeah, one of the things that we hear a lot from parents is well, we don't know what happened afterwards. And I know we have the issue of confidentiality, but we still need to find some way of responding to tell people that, yes, there is a response in process, and that even though the rumors are that somebody's not being dealt with, that in fact they are.
And one additional piece that did come out of one of the West sessions was the police department's invitation to parents to get on their websites. They have four of them by precinct, division,
district.
They are very, very informative and give a real good sense of the surrounding neighborhoods.
And then we heard a little bit about the increased support for victims. Identifying an adult in the school when a student is a victim of a situation or feeling unsafe that they can go to. And it's the key contact person so that the parent can go to this person, the student can go to this person knows them, and so that we begin to identify key adults in the building and situations where we need to provide some support for victims. One of Luis's pieces that he's bringing to the table is developing a system to more clearly track events. And for us, being suspended for a fight doesn't really give us the information. Were there adults from the outside involved in this situation? Do we think it was gang-related in the situation or not? Are there other groups of kids that were involved? Trying to create more of a profile so that we can kind of track some of these events in a better way. And then as you're talking about, are there ways that we need to move resources differently when we have a high profile of what we're tracking?
I think the tracking in more detail is very, very important. Our sense is that most of our violence is not, quote, gang-related. The people involved are members of gangs. They are not fighting over gang issues. That's our sense. But we don't have the data, and we don't track the incidents in a way to tell that that's really true. And the one thing I've learned in years as a coach and years as a principal and superintendent is the one thing you can be sure of is perception is probably wrong. So we really want to get much more detail about each incident so we can begin to do a much better job of identifying where the actual problem is. Because two kids fighting about their girlfriend that one of them has stolen from the other is very, very different than two kids fighting over a drug deal that involved two gangs and breaking into each other's turf. Those are two very different things and are handled very, very differently. So, sorry.
I wanted to go back to the support for victims for a minute, if we could, because I think one of the hardest things, and this is not unique to this year or this time, but it has come up at various points with where you have a situation where somebody's been victimized. Either they were jumped or they were sexually assaulted or whatever, and then they have to go back to school and the perpetrator is also in school. And what's never been clear to me is what tools do we have to help the victim be safe in that school setting when they're having to be in the halls with the perpetrators? Are there limits to what we can do? Are there things that we can and should be doing in conjunction with the police? It's something that's come up, and if I was a parent and I had a child who'd been assaulted or beaten up or whatever had happened, I would be just as worried as the people I've heard from.
Well, several things that need to occur. One is close coordination with the police department to ensure that whatever the school does is going to meet the needs of the school and yet at the same time not do any damage to the criminal investigation. Because if that occurs, then you cannot undo that. and everyone pays the price. But the other one is to sit down with the victim and the family, with the parents. A lot of times there's the assumption made that because an allegation is made about an incident, that automatically the school should be able to sanction that student. And it's important that we be able to educate the family about the fact that we have due process that needs to be followed, not only on the criminal side, but also on the school side, and that the student has rights, the victim has rights. Once we get beyond that point, certainly we can meet the victim's safety needs by sitting down with the parents, the student, the principal, and identifying, for example, how does that student get to school? Are there certain areas within the student's schedule where the student may be vulnerable or feel vulnerable? What is their perception of how safe or unsafe they are? And lots of times, by including the student in that conversation with the parents, we're able to zero in on the issues, and we're able to create a safety net. We're able to identify specific staff members that can take on the responsibility for certain hours or times to work with that student. Someone can be assigned from the school to maintain contact with the principal. Many times it's a social worker, but the principal as well will take on that role. I will also work behind the scenes to coordinate issues with the police department. Has the suspect been interviewed? How is the investigation proceeding? And then maintaining that kind of information update with the family is, all those issues are critical.
We have done everything from, we have transferred kids, if that was appropriate, to other schools. We have also had circumstances, I don't know if we've done this since Luis has been here, but we've had circumstances where we've actually had cases where we have to have the child in the school. And we have eyes on the threat all the time. We have somebody who is always eyes on from the time they get to school till they leave. We've had cases where we have people in specific places in the building that may be a threat. It's really very individual, but we have the capability of doing any of those things depending on the circumstance and the time.
If we were dealing with cases outside of the school system, suppose that, you know, there's a fight on State Street involving people who are not even close to in the school system, isn't there some provision within the criminal justice system to set limits on the contact between the accused and the victim? And do we use any of those limits with the students coming back into our schools in terms of advising the accused, you know, of what the boundaries are and what...
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, when a student commits a crime, whether it occurs in school or outside of school, the courts provide us with information, and actually this is a copy of a form that we have. It's called the court adjudication process, and it provides us notification. So, for example, if I am charged today, and simply I'm charged, then we'll receive notice that a delinquency petition has been filed. Once I go to court, and if I am found guilty, I'll receive notice of a delinquency adjudication, which actually will contain a copy of the court order that indicate the specific restrictions on the student. So it may include such as that particular student is not to have any contact with other students. And once I receive this, then I review it, I share it with the school principals, and the principals then take an active role to ensure that the court restrictions are being enforced.
Thank you.
Just one comment. But if we think it's necessary, jurisdiction has to do with discipline and punishment. If we have a case where we think, if it's day one and it's just now beginning in the process, but we feel that we have a child in school that either needs to be protected or feels that they need to be protected, we're capable of putting that in place from day one. The jurisdiction issue really is because we're not punishing anybody, we're protected. So.
I think I would say we're ready to wrap up. Any other questions about the final section?
I might make one comment that we missed before we move on, and that is that in discussing with our middle school principals, one of the things that they feel very strongly about and that we're looking at very strongly is is some additional alternative environments, basically short term to a year for students who are having difficulty fitting into their environment, and we're looking at that, and that may be one of the things that we also bring forward.
Mr. Winston?
Yeah, just quickly, just to piggyback on that, Superintendent, how much money are we talking about, again, with the special education funds? Is that about $1 million or something?
We're sure we have about $865,000, is my recollection, depending on toward the end of the year, they'll audit all the numbers, and sure, it could go as high as $1 million, but we're pretty sure of $865,000 or so, and that's what we would come to the board to use.
Okay, and do you have a timeline in terms of when that might take place, second semester or?
We hope to do it, to have our plans in place of what we would come ask you to before the Christmas break.
Okay. Did we receive any additional funding from the state for security at all that didn't go through?
No.
Okay. Is that something that, in terms of Joe Quick, is he continuing to lobby for that, or, you know, at least discuss?
Yeah, it'll be the next biennium before it can come back up, I think. So, but yeah, and we think it's a very important thing, and obviously the legislature did. So.
Okay, thank you.
Ms. Cole.
I'll try to be quick. Couple things is, at some point, based on all these recommendations, I don't know if the superintendent can answer this, but is there any interest in having the board look at implementing a policy to make sure that I'm mostly concerned with procedures are followed to increase support for victims, given the fact that we're starting to get this kind of complicated set of circumstances where a lot of things happen outside of the district, and what can we do to make sure that that procedures are in place so that it's consistent?
Well, I mean, I think most of the things that we've talked about here are really administrative kinds of procedures that we would implement. Again, I think advise us about where you want to go and support us with resources when we ask for them. But I think most of the things we're talking about are really just administrative procedures within our schools. I don't see them as policy issues, at least from my standpoint.
Yeah, I guess
if we ran into something we felt was a policy issue that needed to be put into place, we would do that.
I guess my big concern is back to what Ms. Carstensen and others have said, which is that as the board members, we're the ones that hear from the parents that are concerned about that issues are getting addressed. And for us, we need to be able to respond in a way that develops a trusting relationship with all of these different parents that may have ideas that aren't necessarily correct, but that's what I'm kind of looking for.
My suggestion is that you refer them to us. As individual board members, many of these things you're not entitled to the information about. Remembering that the student, the privacy laws apply to you also unless you're acting as a board on some specific issue like an expulsion. So the best thing in those kind of cases is to refer them to me or refer them to Steve or Pam or Sue or whoever is appropriate, and they can share the information that they can share. And usually we can share enough so that the parent understands exactly what's happening. That's normally my recommendation, because as individual board members, it's going to be impossible, particularly in the case of student kinds of issues, for you to respond in a way. And we're not going to be able to give you the information to respond in a way.
Then another thing is, I'm hoping that Joe's still awake over there. All right. I'm wondering if you can give us a reaction if you had seen the security information document from West and what your reaction was as a student, or if you've heard of anyone that. Just general comments so that you're on the ground.
Well, speaking as a student, and I've said this before with regard to security issues in the school, but as important as these issues are, and as necessary it is for us to look at them. They're really not a large part of student life. Everyday school life does not entail fights, really, or really dealing with fights. And so the reaction from much of the student body was, thank you for this information. It's not unwanted, but it was, at least from what I saw, viewed as a tad unnecessary. That's not necessarily the case for specific groups of students or for specific instances within the schools, but a comforting thing during discussions like this is the knowledge that these issues are not universally serious. And so my reaction was a positive one, and I was glad the district was taking steps to work towards these goals.
Did you bring it home to your mom? Or
I did not. I did not receive one of those wonderful booklets.
Oh, okay.
Perhaps my parents didn't tell me.
See, I knew to ask you this question. And then finally, just one other thing is that I always I do this with my boys at home, but and I go into various different schools, and sometimes I can get into different doors, and we've had this discussion about only having one entrance, and I just think random checks occasionally by either staff or someone else is really helpful to make sure that this issue is being taken care of, because I think it's a simple issue, which is just randomly checking to make sure that only one entrance per school.
I think I can speak for our staff that we do that. But if you look at a place like West, I just happen to know off the top of my head that there are 83 doors, 83 ground level doors into West High School. So the only way you're going to be sure that they're all locked is you have 83 staff members who stand at that door 24 hours a day, because the temptation to let your friend in overcomes any fear that you might have of who else is coming in. But I think I can speak for our staff that as they move around, they do check those.
Ms. Carson.
She had the opposite experience. Everywhere I go, the dadgum door is locked. And I have to walk all the way around.
I was going to say, I had that experience at Marquette School, and I was waiting for some security person to come and tackle me. And all I wanted to do was go see Ms. McBee.
This is just to follow up on Joe and Joe's comment. And I think that it's very important that we keep it in perspective and that we are focusing on a particular issue, but it is not, as Joe said, the common experience, day-to-day experience of our students. And I also think it's wise to remember as board members that sometimes the context we get from the public are based more on rumor and gossip than actual reality, and that it's that, well, part of our role is to help them kind of get the information, but also to sort of reduce the hysteria level some. Because when there is an incident, there are all sorts of stories that begin to circulate, and I think that we have to keep in mind our dual functions of both making sure the system is responding, but also making sure that the community is getting accurate information on these things.
I just want to say to the principals that are here and the principals that are out in the audience, thank you for what you do. And again, your leadership is very much appreciated. And I know, you know, when we talk about issues like this, you know, in terms of the community, in terms of our board and things, I know it's difficult, but just want to let you know that, again, your work is valued and appreciated. And look forward to the superintendent bringing forth the investment plan. You know, hopefully that'll get a thumbs up by the board.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you. It was very helpful.
Thank you.
We'll take two. Really two this time.
Yeah.